This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Everyone loves a Halloween story, and our volunteers have got a few to tell you. So, welcome to the TRRS Midnight Macabre. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Listen to TRRS for announcements about program times, or check our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org to review our complete schedule. Or call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
So who's with me tonight?
Hi, I'm Kara Smith.
I'm Jeff Nugent.
Lindsay Moore here.
Fred Corlett here.
Hello, I'm Diane Corlett.
White House Ghosts, a Washington, D.C. ghost story retold by S. E. Schlosser. It is said that Lincoln's ghost haunts the White House. He appears in the room where the Lincoln bed is kept. Harry Truman once responded to a 3 a.m. knock on his door and found no one there. He attributed the knock to Lincoln. Lincoln is said to return to the White House when the security of the country is at risk. He strides up and down the second-floor hallway, raps at doors, and stands by certain windows with his hands clasped behind his back. One staff member claimed to have seen Lincoln sitting on his bed, pulling on his boots. A bodyguard to President Harrison was kept awake many nights trying to protect the president from mysterious footsteps he heard in the hall. He grew so tired and worried, he finally attended a séance to beg President Lincoln to stop so he could get enough sleep to properly protect the president. Abigail Adams' ghost was seen drifting through the closed doors of the East Room to hang the laundry during the Taft administration. A gardener claims to have spoken to the ghost of Dolly Madison, who reproved him for trying to remove the rose bushes she had planted over 100 years ago. In the 1930s, Andrew Jackson's ghost could be heard laughing in the Rose Room. In 1952, extensive repairs were done to the second floor of the White House. Since then, the ghosts have not walked so actively.
Lost, a Yukon ghost story, retold by S. E. Schlosser. They say that there once was a prospector wandering through the Yukon with his two dogs, searching for gold. One evening, as it neared dusk, he found himself mired down in the muskeg, boggy country with water just underneath the surface of the semi-frozen ground and just above the permafrost. It was a treacherous place, and would be very easy to sink beneath the surface and be engulfed. The more the prospector and his dogs tried to free themselves from its clutches, the more lost they became. Finally, the prospector found a firm spot on a small hill. There were a few scraggly trees on the elevation, and he made a small fire and cooked up a bit of soup for himself and his canine companions. As the stars came out overhead, the man tried to find a comfortable place to sleep, knowing that in the morning he and the dogs would once again face the quagmire. At last, the prospector fell into an uneasy sleep. As he slept, he dreamt that a fierce native warrior was standing over him, threatening him with a spear. "Why have you invaded this sacred ground?" the warrior demanded. "Leave at once, or I will kill you." "I'm lost in the muskeg," the prospector said in his dream. "Show me the way out, and I will gladly leave." The warrior frowned down at him. "I am the protector of this place, and cannot forsake it, but I will summon a guide for you." The warrior raised his arms toward the sky and called something in a tongue the prospector could not understand. Then he vanished. The prospector was awakened by the sudden growling of his dogs. Sitting up, he beheld the glowing figure of a beautiful Native American woman standing at the bottom of the hill. He blinked in amazement and felt chills run all over his body. The woman beckoned to him,
and to his surprise, his dogs ceased their growling and ran up to her. They pranced around her like pups, and he felt his fear fade away. Packing up his gear, the prospector made his way down the darkened hillock to the treacherous muskeg that surrounded it. The glowing woman smiled at him. She raised her arms in the same gesture used by the warrior in his dream and transformed into a beautiful snow-white hare. The glowing hare hopped slowly ahead of the prospector, leading him eastward. The prospector followed it closely, deviating neither left nor right from its path. The dogs followed him eagerly and showed no interest in chasing the hare. For several hours, the prospector and his dogs followed the glowing animal through the treacherous twists and turns of the quagmire. Just before dawn, they reached solid ground. The prospector looked around and knew where he was. Ahead of him, the white hare became once more the beautiful, glowing figure of a woman. The dogs danced up to her, and she patted them on the head. Then she offered the prospector a sweet smile and vanished as the first rays of the sun pierced the horizon.
Vampire Hermit, a scary New York folktale, retold by S.E. Schlosser. She was nervous when her husband said they were to stay in the abandoned house, for it contained the corpse of the hermit who once lived there, enshrined in a coffin in the loft. It was an old custom, and no longer popular among the Iroquois people, but the hermit had insisted upon it before his death. They were good hunting in this place, her man had declared, and so they moved in, and she unpacked their few belongings in the front room, refusing to go up into the loft where the hermit's body lay. When her husband left to hunt, she immediately put her daughter in the sling on her back and went to look for roots and berries, staying away until her husband returned with the meat. As she prepared the evening meal for them, her husband, tired from his hunting, climbed up into the loft to rest. The hut soon filled with the delicious smell of roasting meat. She was sorting through the berries when she heard a muffled cry and the crunch of breaking bones. As she stared upward, frozen in horror, blood started to drip from the rafters. She crept silently to the far corner of the room, where she could see up into the loft. A skeleton with glowing red eye sockets was feasting on the body of her husband, its teeth and chin covered with blood. Her daughter stirred restlessly at her back, and she knew that she had to get away immediately. "I'm going to run down to the stream to fetch water for the broth," she called towards the loft. "I'll be right back." She took the pail and walked toward the stream, trying to appear normal. As soon as she was out of sight among the trees, she started to run as fast as she could. She heard a terrible howl from the direction of the house as the creature heard them escaping and started to pursue. The young mother stumbled desperately through the woods, the creature's howls growing closer as it pursued them. Her little daughter wailed in fright at her back as she fled in terror, sobbing, and was almost without hope. The monster was gaining on her. In a last act of despair, she shouted the Iroquois distress cry, hoping someone would be near enough to hear it. Her call was taken up and answered by the warriors from the village. She could hear the creature breathing behind her as she sprinted to the trees at the edge of the village. Here, her strength failed her, and she collapsed to the ground. Just before the monster could pounce on them, a party of warriors burst through the gates of the village, chasing the skeleton away. They swung their torches wide, and the skeleton retreated farther into the woods. The warriors chased the creature back to the hermit's house and set fire to the cabin. As the flames encompassed the house, a terrible howling and roaring came from the loft, and the vampire hermit fled into the woods in the form of a rabbit, never again to plague the young woman or her daughter.
Raw Head and Bloody Bones, a Missouri ghost story, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Way back in the deep woods, there lived a scrawny old woman who had a reputation for being the best conjuring woman in the Ozarks. With her bedraggled black and gray hair, funny eyes, one yellow and one green, and her crooked nose, old Betty was not a pretty picture. But she was the best there was at fixing what ailed a man, and that was all that counted. Old Betty's house was full of herbs and roots and bottles filled with conjuring medicine. The walls were lined with strange books brimming with magical spells. Old Betty was the only one living in the hollow who knew how to read. Her granny, who was also a conjurer, had taught her the skill as part of her magical training. Just about the only friend old Betty had was a tough, mean, ugly old razorback hog that ran wild around her place. It rooted so much in her kitchen garbage that all the leftover spells started affecting it. Some folks swore up and down that the old razorback hog sometimes walked upright like a man. One fellow claimed he'd seen the pig sitting in the rocker on old Betty's porch, chattering away to her while she stewed up some potions in the kitchen. But everyone discounted that story on account of the fellow who told it was a little too fond of moonshine. Rawhead was the name old Betty gave the razorback, referring maybe to the way the ugly creature looked a bit like some of the dead pigs come butchering time down in Hogscald Hollow. The razorback didn't mind the funny name. Rawhead kept following old Betty around in her little cabin and rooting up the kitchen leftovers. He'd even walked to town with her when she came to the local mercantile to sell her home remedies. Well, folks in town got so used to seeing Rawhead and old Betty around the town that it looked mighty strange one day around hong-driving time when old Betty came to the mercantile without him. "Where's Rawhead?" the owner asked as he accepted her basket full of home remedy potions. The liquid in the bottles swished in an agitated manner as old Betty said, "I ain't seen him around today, and I'm mighty worried. You seen him here in town?" "Nobody's seen him around today. They would have told me if they did," the mercantile owner said. "We'll keep a lookout for you." "That's mighty kind of you. If you see him, tell him to come home straight away," old Betty said. The mercantile owner nodded agreement as he handed over her weekly pay. Old Betty fussed herself all the way home. It wasn't like Rawhead to disappear, especially not on the day they went to town. The man at the mercantile always saved the best scraps for the mean old razorback, and Rawhead never missed a visit. When the old conjuring woman got home, she mixed up a potion and poured it onto a flat plate. "Where's that old hog got to?" she asked the liquid. It clouded over, and then a series of pictures formed. First, old Betty saw the good-for-nothing hunter that lived on the next ridge sneaking around the forest, rounding up razorback hogs that didn't belong to him. One of the hogs was Rawhead. Then she saw him taking the hogs down to Hogscald Hollow, where folks from the next town were slaughtering their razorbacks. Then she saw her hog, Rawhead, slaughtered with the rest of the pigs and hung up for gutting. The final picture in the liquid was the pile of bloody bones that had once been her hog, and his scraped clean head lying with the other hogs' heads in a pile. Old Betty was infuriated by the death of her only friend. It was murder to her, plain and simple. Everyone in three counties knew that Rawhead was her friend, and that lazy, hog-stealing, good-for-nothing hunter on the ridge was going to pay for slaughtering him. Now, old Betty tried to practice white conjuring most of the time, but she knew the dark secrets, too. She pulled out an old secret book her granny had given her and turned to the very last page. She lit several candles and put them around the plate containing the liquid picture of Rawhead and his bloody bones. Then she began to chant, "Rawhead and bloody bones! Rawhead and bloody bones!" The light from the windows disappeared as if the sun had been snuffed out like a candle. Dark clouds billowed into the clearing where old Betty's cabin stood, and the howl of dark spirits could be heard in the wind that pummeled the treetops. "Rawhead and bloody bones! Rawhead and bloody bones!" Betty continued to chant until a bolt of silver lightning left the plate and streaked out through the window, heading in the direction of Hogscald Hollow. When the silver light struck Rawhead's severed head, which was piled on the hunter's wagon with the other hogs' heads, it tumbled to the ground and rolled until it was touching the bloody bones that had once inhabited its body. As the hunter's wagon rumbled away towards the ridge where he lived, the enchanted Rawhead called out, "Bloody bones, get up and dance!" Immediately, the bloody bones reassembled themselves into the skeleton of a razorback hog walking upright, as Rawhead had often done when he was alone with old Betty. The head hopped up on top of his skeleton, and Rawhead went searching through the woods for weapons to use against the hunter. He borrowed the sharp teeth of a dying panther, the claws of a long-dead bear, and the tail from a rotting raccoon, and put them over his skinned head and bloody bones. Then Rawhead headed up the track towards the ridge, looking for the hunter who had slaughtered him. Rawhead slipped past a thief on the road and slid into the barn where the hunter kept his horse and wagon. Rawhead climbed up into the loft and waited for the hunter to come home. It was dusk when the hunter drove into the barn and unhitched his horses. The horses snorted in fear, sensing the presence of Rawhead in the loft. Wondering what was disturbing his usually calm horse, the hunter looked around and saw a large pair of eyes staring down at him from the darkness in the loft. The hunter frowned, thinking it was one of the local kids fooling around in his barn. "Land of Goshen, what have you got those big eyes for?" he snapped, thinking the kids were trying to scare him with some crazy mask. "To see your grave," Rawhead rumbled very softly. The hunter snorted irritably and put his horse into the stall. "Very funny, ha ha," the hunter said. When he came out of the stall, he saw Rawhead had crept forward a bit further. Now his luminous yellow eyes and his bear claws could clearly be seen. "Land of Goshen, what have you got those big claws for?" he snapped. "You look ridiculous." "To dig your grave," Rawhead intoned softly, his voice a deep rumble that raised the hairs on the back of the hunter's neck. He stirred uneasily, not sure how the crazy kid in his loft could have made such a scary sound, if it really was a crazy kid. Feeling a little spooked, he hurried to the door and let himself out of the barn. Rawhead slipped out of the loft and climbed down the side of the barn behind him. With nary a rustle to reveal his presence, Rawhead raced through the trees and up the path to a large, moonlit rock. He hid in the shadows of the huge stone so that the only thing showing were his gleaming yellow eyes, his bear claws, and his raccoon tail. When the hunter came level with the rock on the side of the path, he gave a startled yelp. Staring at Rawhead, he gasped, "You nearly knocked the heart right out of me, you crazy kid! Land of Goshen, what do you got that crazy tail for?" "To sweep your grave," Rawhead boomed, his enchanted voice echoing through the woods, getting louder and louder with each echo. The hunter took to his heels and ran for his cabin. He raced past the old well house, past the woodpile, over the rotted fence, and into his yard. But Rawhead was faster. When the hunter reached his porch, Rawhead leapt for the shadows and loomed above him. The hunter stared up in terror at Rawhead's gleaming yellow eyes in the ugly razorback hogshead, his bloody bone skeleton with its long bear claws, swooping raccoon's tail, and his gleaming sharp panther teeth. "Land of Goshen, what have you got those big teeth for?" he gasped desperately, stumbling backward from the terrible figure before him. "To eat you up, like you wanted to eat me," Rawhead roared, descending upon the good-for-nothing hunter. The murdering thief gave one long scream in the moonlight. Then there was silence and the sound of crunching. Nothing more was ever seen or heard of the lazy hunter who lived on the ridge. His horse also disappeared that night. But sometimes folks would see Rawhead roaming through the forest in the company of his friend Old Betty. And once a month, on the night of the full moon, Rawhead would ride the hunter's horse through town, wearing the old man's blue overalls over his bloody bones, with the hole cut out for his raccoon tail. In his bloody, bear-clawed hands, he carried his raw, razorback hogshead, lifting it high against the full moon for everyone to see.
Fetch, retold by S.E. Schlosser. Clyde was the best dog I ever had. He was a black, gray, and tan German Shepherd mix with a keen sense of smell and a quirky disposition. I loved him. He was always happy, always friendly. He went to every class I took at Appalachian State University, sitting at my feet and listening intently. After class, we would wander outdoors and play a game of fetch or go for a hike. Sometimes we even studied. I would have aced every class if the professor had let Clyde take the test. Well, we graduated, Clyde with top honors, at least among the students, and had a brief hiatus in the Outer Banks.
We loved the beaches and the wind and the waves, me and Clyde. But I was a mountain boy at heart, and the yen for the hills grew so strong within me that I came back to Boone. Clyde didn't mind where we were, so long as we stuck together. I bought a nice little one-story ranch house with a full basement, and in time, brought home a bride to live there with the two of us. Sadly, my relationship with both Clyde and the little ranch house outlasted my relationship with my wife. I was pretty devastated by the divorce, and it didn't help matters when my best buddy Clyde died of sheer old age. Tough, strong, mountain man that I am, I bawled like a baby when I buried old Clyde in the front yard. There had never been another dog quite like him. I stuck it out in the house for 2 years after the divorce, but finally decided it was time to buy a condo and move on with my life. That little old house had too many memories, and no Clyde to soften them. My sister and brother-in-law helped me pack up my things. On the day of the move, they loaded up their truck and headed off to the condo, leaving me to finish packing my own truck. I parked it on the street, right in front of the house, and trotted back and forth with packages and boxes, leaving the big old mirror that was propped outside the front door for last, since it needed special packaging so that it wouldn't break during the trip. I was down to the last few items when I stepped out of the door carrying a box and almost tripped over a stick laying smack dab in the middle of the front walk. I frowned down at it. Where did that come from? It hadn't been there on my last trip out to the truck, and there was no wind that could have knocked it off a tree into the path. It was, I observed casually, just the type of stick that Clyde always favored when we played fetch. About a foot long and about an inch thick. The wood had a knot at the center that looked like a cat's eye. I felt a pang of loss when I saw the stick. Oh, how I missed Clyde! Adjusting the box on my hip, I scooped up the stick and threw it into the backyard, chucking it right over the low roof of the ranch house. Then I walked out to the truck and carefully loaded my box with the others. Turning, I headed back toward the house to pick up the last few boxes, and there was the stick again, exactly where it had been before. My flesh crawled. I felt goosebumps rising on my arms and legs. How had it gotten back here? It was the same funny stick I'd just thrown over the house. I could tell by the knot at its center that looked like a cat's eye. I glanced around the yard, but no one was there. No way to explain the stick. Hastily, feeling chills all over my skin, I picked it up and threw it over the roof of the house again. Then I headed in the front door. As I did, I glanced in the mirror propped up against the wall. In the bottom corner, standing reflected on the exterior walkway just where the stick had been, stood Clyde. His black and tan ears were pricked, his dark eyes glowed with delight, and his tail was wagging. There was no doubt it was Clyde. Now I loved that dog more than anything, but seeing his ghost reflected in that mirror seriously freaked me out. I gasped, blinked, and then hurried to the bedroom to grab the final box off the bed. When I returned to the front hallway, there was nothing reflected in the mirror, except empty walkway. I snatched up the old mirror any which way, locked the front door with shaking hands, and hurried down the walk to the truck parked out front. I didn't look down. I really didn't want to see if the stick was back. A moment later, I was in the truck with my blasted old mirror tucked against the passenger seat. My hands were shaking so badly that it took me 2 tries to get the engine started. Then the truck was in gear, and I was gone. Goodbye, house. Goodbye, old life. I hit my blinker and slowed for the left turn. Just before I rounded the corner, I glanced in the rearview mirror, staring back at the house. Was that a hint of black and tan by the walkway? The swish of a wagging tail? A car rumbled past, cutting off my view. By the time I could see it again, the yard was empty. Goodbye, Clyde.
Wait Until Emmett Comes, a West Virginia ghost story. retold by S. E. Schlosser. A preacher was riding to one of the churches on his circuit when darkness fell. It was about to storm, and the only house nearby was an old mansion which was reputed to be haunted. The preacher clutched his Bible and said, "The Lord will take care of me." He went into the mansion just as the storm broke. He put his horse into the barn and made his way into the house. The door was unlocked. He went into a large room which contained a fireplace that filled one wall. There was wood laid for a fire. He laid a match to it. Then the preacher sat down to read his Bible. Gradually, the fire burned down to a heap of coals as the storm howled around the mansion. The preacher was roused from his reading by a sound. He looked up from his Bible. A very large black cat was stretching itself. Then he walked to the fire and sat down among the red-hot coals. It picked a coal up in its paw and licked it slowly. The cat got up, shook off the ashes, and walked to the foot of the preacher's chair. It fixed blazing yellow eyes upon him, black tail lashing, and said quietly, "Wait until Emmett comes." The preacher jumped from Genesis to Matthew in shock. He had never heard of a cat talking before. Nervously, he kept reading his Bible, muttering to himself, "The Lord will take care of me." 2 minutes later, another cat came into the room. It was black as midnight, and as large as the biggest dog. It lay down among the red-hot coals, lazily batting themselves with enormous paws. Then it walked over to the other cat and said, "What shall we do with him?" The first cat replied, "We should not do anything until Emmett comes." The two cats, black as midnight, sat watching the preacher, who read through the Gospels at top speed, aware of blazing yellow eyes watching him. A third cat, big as a tiger, entered the room. It went to the fire full of red-hot coals and rolled among them, chewing them and spitting them out. Then it came to the other two cats, facing the preacher in the chair. "What shall we do with him?" it growled to the others. "We shall not do anything until Emmett comes," the other cats replied together. The preacher flipped to Revelation, looking furtively around the room. He closed the Bible and stood up. "Good night, cats. I am glad of your company, but when Emmett comes, you done tell him I been hell and went."
You've been listening to a session of Midnight Macabre on Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. If you want to check out our program guide, please visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. While you're there, you might notice we have several programs on podcast. Meanwhile, this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm Kurt Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. From me and from my fellow readers, good night.